Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 10 of Retail Ramblings. We're into double digits now, but before we get into the week or the month or however long it's been of retail, let's have a recap of what we touched on in our last episode. So from the winner's side of things, Marsha, I'll let you kick us off.
Yeah, so we highlighted a really exciting partnership that's coming down the line for Mac and Puma. So we're really excited to see where that goes, but so far it has the makings of something really cool.
Yeah, definitely. And I touched on Lowe's and their deal to sell Craftsman tools exclusively in North America through their stores. And what a watershed moment that was for Lowe's, particularly in comparison with the competition that they face from the Home Depot.
And on the loser side of things, I had the Danskin delisting at Walmart and the implications that held for the brand, but looking at it wider for other brands and what they could do to kind of prevent something like that from happening.
And we also talked about Sherwin-Williams. We've talked a lot about the natural disasters that have happened in the United States, particularly in the summer of 2017, but we talked about Sherwin-Williams and a poor quarter that they had in Q3, which was largely attributed to the natural disasters in the United States. And then on the retail roadmap side of things, I apologize, I was waiting for Marsha there, but this was actually my section that I spoke about. We talked about the future layout of brick and mortar stores and malls in North America, and that one for me was a really exciting topic. So if you haven't gone back and listened to that, I'd strongly recommend it. It's a really interesting discussion about what's going to happen to those retail spaces moving forward, and what it stands for brands as well.
Yeah, that's probably the most passionate that Chris has ever been on this podcast. Yeah. We'll see. Maybe he'll beat that today. We have some exciting stuff coming up. Yeah. Definitely take a listen back to that one. And lastly, last week, we also had our data dive. And there we spoke about Shiseido's acquisition of the AI startup Giran. I'm still not sure if I'm saying that correctly. but that was a really interesting look at kind of the trend of these big brands acquiring small startups to really help them move faster in the field.
All right. So that's everything we touched on last episode. Let's jump into episode 10 and the meat of the episode and really talk about begin talking about the winners and losers. Okay, so I'm going to kick us off this week with our first winner. And the first winner that I've picked out is an organization who are based out of Texas, and they're called the Siwi Bath Company. So if you don't know or you haven't heard of the Siwi Bath Company before, they started in 2010 by Allison and Adam Grossman. And it was started when Adam, who suffers from psoriasis, was looking for a cure to a lot of the inflammation that happened that's associated with the disease, and actually found that bladder rack seaweed was an adequate cure and would actually reduce the amount of inflammation that he would have. As a result, Adam and Allison went ahead and actually created a product that largely uses bladder rack seaweed. They pull it off the coast of Portland, Maine, and it's said to help detoxify and hydrate skin and hair. Now, it's very much an example of organizations that we talk about as sustainable and indie beauty brands, and I know Marsha's touched a lot on those in some previous retail roadmaps and data dives. And the reason that we've picked them out as a big winner this week is they've actually announced that they're expanding into 2,000 CVS stores. Now, it's a pretty meteoric rise for an organization such as ourselves, and is kind of testament to where this whole indie beauty brand thing is at the moment. To give you a little bit of context of what's happened over the 6 years with the Siwi Bath Company, they basically got into their first retail store in a central market store in Texas in 2011, where they actually met a buyer at a trade show that they attended. And it's kind of testament to how important trade shows are to meet those buyers and establish those connections and get into door and continue to maintain those connections. And I know, Marsha, we spoke about it a lot, both in the Ultimate Guides that we've published, and we've kind of seen it firsthand how important those trade shows truly are. So Siwi Bath Company is kind of case in point of an organization who actually went to a trade show and managed to get into retail doors.
Yeah, that's major. I think like something that probably helped them a lot there is the great story that they have.
Yeah.
That resonates, I think, across any industry when an entrepreneur actually starts a company based on their own need and a problem that they're facing themselves. Even here at Ascuity, like funny story, that's how Ascuity was started as well. Our CEO found the problem of not being able to really aggregate POS data in an easy to use way. And that's how Skuity was started. So I think that's the reason why they really resonated at trade shows.
Yeah, definitely. Their narrative went so far as to being picked up by Whole Foods in 2011. And they probably had a little bit more consistent growth up until 2016 when they were then picked up by Target. So it's probably a stretch from Target to pick up a brand such as theirs. It doesn't naturally associate with Target. However, they've been tremendously successful after testing online first. And the reason that I kind of wanted to point them out as a winner as well, Marcia, is there's a few themes here that we kind of talk about a lot in our line of business. And it is about expanding into new stores and really making sure that you do it sustainably and understand both how you've performed in the past and estimate how you're going to perform in the future based on historical performance. And it's something that we know that really establishes a strong relationship with your buyer. And it's testament to how important that relationship with the buyer as well. We've also spoken about indie beauty brands before in the past, and these guys are a quintessential example of an indie beauty brand really taking control of the market that they're in and expanding into retail, conventional brick and mortar retail, and really being successful. And as I've briefly touched on before, it's all about the relationship with the buyer, right? It just shows how strong that these guys have been able to grow these relationships and how they're going from strength to strength. So Marcia, who do you have for the winner this week?
So the winner that I want to talk about this week is Mattel. And I think it's really great to have a winner in the toy industry, just because, I mean, this is happening on the backdrop of the industry that's kind of there in deep change, and there's things happening like the bankruptcy of Toys R Us, and several other changes that are happening as well. So Mattel, as some of you probably know, they've been approached by the toy giant Hasbro about a potential takeover. So with this, Mattel's shares have surged more than 20% after they were approached. Hasbro is also, I would say, a winner in this case. Their shares also rose 7.5%. Just to give you guys a background of how big this would actually be if this went through, Mattel is worth $5 billion, while Hasbro is worth about $11
billion. Yeah.
So these are two of the biggest toy companies that there are. If the two of them combined forces, it would be, I mean, it would put brands such as Barbie and Transformers under the same roof, yeah. Which, I mean, that's everything in the toy industry. So at the moment where the deal kind of stands, Mattel has informed Hasbro that its proposal actually undervalues the company and doesn't take sufficiently into account the potential for regulators to reject the deal based on antitrust concerns. The actual terms of the deal haven't been released either, so I can't comment on that. And it's not clear whether the negotiations between the two companies will continue. And they have actually engaged in multiple rounds of deal talks over the last two decades. But if this deal was actually consummated, like I said, it would really bring together two of the largest U.S. toy makers. So I'm really interested to see where this goes. But regardless of what happens, I think with this share surge of 20%, Mattel is definitely a winner right now.
Yeah, I'd agree. And it'll be interesting to see kind of what strategies the brands would take if they were given together, because they're so used to competing with each other.
Exactly. Yeah, that will be very, very interesting to watch.
Yeah, it's a huge deal. So let's jump across to our losers for the particular episode that we've got this week. All right, so as I did with the winners, I'm going to kick us off with the losers. And my big loser this week is actually up in the air. I haven't quite decided who the bigger loser is. The fact of the matter is there is going to be one loser, but I'm probably going to let Marcia decide on this one. So it basically comes out of the news that Sears is no longer going to sell Whirlpool products. Now, this is a pretty big deal because Whirlpool's actually been sold at Sears. I believe the relationship goes back to 1916, so it's over a 100-year-old relationship. And Sears, wow, yeah, Sears actually had a stake in the company back in 1921 when it forgave a loan that Whirlpool had taken out with Sears. And over the years, they've actually been very much involved in pioneering the appliance industry and selling the appliance industry. Now, with this here, Whirlpool won't be selling any more products, all their subsidiary products won't be sold either. So this includes Maytag, KitchenAid's a really huge one, and Gen Air as well. Sears' ability to build Kenmore branded products was not affected by this decision. So Whirlpool is actually involved in the manufacturing process of Kenmore products, and that hasn't been affected, which I guess is good news for Sears. And this comes after Whirlpool informed Sears that they would stop supplying products in May, which largely arose due to a pricing dispute. Now, who's the biggest loser out of this? There's two arguments and there's two sides of the coin, right? So Sears have come out and said that Whirlpool has sought to use its dominant position in the marketplace to make demands that would have prohibited us from offering Whirlpool products to our members at a reasonable price. Pardon me. It's more difficult for Sears now to recover lost market share in the appliance market. A massive thing about this is the appliance market is super competitive at the moment. Sears was once synonymous with the appliance market, but they've lost a great deal of market share. I think the highest I saw their market share was at about 40 or 50%. And they were the undisputed first place retailer for appliances, but they fell to second to Lowe's, I believe, about 5 years ago. And now they're actually third behind the Home Depot as well. And Best Buy is actually closing on Sears now. They have a 13% market share, and Best Buy is actually getting really close to them. So,
wow, I didn't realize that.
Yes. So these retailers have overtaken them, and their core competency is not necessarily appliances. And you would associate Sears probably more so with appliances than what you would with, say, the Home Depot or Lowe's. But they've made an enormous amount of ground on Sears over, say, the last 10, 20 years as Sears has continued to struggle. And much of their strength in major appliances dated to its long-term relationship with Whirlpool. We spoke about in a previous episode Kenmore. So Sears has actually decided to start retailing their Kenmore products through Amazon, which is an effort to try and improve their appliances offering. And Kenmore is actually owned by Sears. So that's kind of a move that they've done recently to try and again establish a foothold within that market. But those are the facts, I guess, for why Sears is the big loser. Whirlpool, on the other hand, they're the largest appliance manufacturer in the world. This amount of sales that they have at Sears is around 3% of their total sales, but it is a loss retail outlet, right? So they're going to be in front of less consumers, irrespective of who the retailer is. Sears still has a massive footprint, particularly in the United States, not so much in Canada anymore. So those are essentially going to be taken off shelves or off the floor, which is a big loss for Whirlpool, and their share price has taken a hit recently as well. This news came about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and their shares immediately fell 6.6%. So they definitely lost in that regard. They're probably estimating $600 million in lost sales for Sears, and the whole retail floor space argument is a big one on why Whirlpool's maybe the bigger loser here. There's been a massive floor space war between LG Electronics and Samsung Electronics as well, who have actually been offering prices on some of their products below cost to try and ensure that they've got the most prominent location on shop floors. And this has created a really, really competitive landscape. So to me, they're both losers, right? It's a difficulty to pull out who is probably the biggest loser out of this one. Nobody wins when a brand gets taken off the shelf of a retailer.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, like I wish they could have come to some kind of like mutual agreement that would have been beneficial to both. Really unfortunate to hear this.
I feel like that's kind of where it is with Sears at the moment, though. I feel like because they're in such a difficult position financially, a lot of brands have decided to take advantage of this. And I guess Whirlpool is probably the most prominent example. But, you know, I think Sears is probably the bigger loser here. Just out of the fact that they're in such a difficult position, and Whirlpool is the largest appliance manufacturer in the world. In saying that, I also think Whirlpool is a huge loser, right? I think in such a competitive landscape and in such a competitive industry, to be taken off the shelves of any retailer is not good news. So I don't know. I'll probably put Sears as our bigger loser, but Whirlpool's definitely a loser too. What do you think, Marsha?
Yeah, Chris, I have to agree with you there. I mean, I respect that Whirlpool wouldn't lower their prices to stay on Sears, because I think that would really devalue their brand.
Mm.
And then it would put them in a more difficult situation with other retailers that they're in. So I really respect that they're kind of standing strong there. And I think like maybe they let it happen. They let themselves be taken off the shelves because they probably have some exciting stuff coming up in the future. Maybe more innovation in their product line, maybe more e-commerce. And then other promotions and things that they could be doing with their other retailers. I think they have more wiggle room to kind of save themselves from this one. And Sears just seems to be scrambling a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. Who do you have as our loser or your loser for this week, Marsha?
So the loser that I have this week is Forever 21. And it's actually interesting because just a couple episodes ago, I had them as a winner with their introduction of the Riley Rose beauty concept. But in this recent week, there was a few news releases that really caught my eye. And basically, Forever 21 is investigating a POS security data breach. And working at Acuity, whenever I see the words POS, data, and security breach, that's an automatic loser for sure. Me.
Definitely.
So the facts of the matter are Forever 21 is investigating a report that it received from a third party that payment cards used in some of its stores in recent months might have been subject to unauthorized access. So like other retailers, Forever 21 does use encryption and tokenization services on their point of sale devices. And they've been doing this since 2015. But the company is saying that the unauthorized access appears to have occurred only on certain devices at times when the encryption on those devices was not operating. So another big reason why this puts Forever 21 as a loser is the timing of when this is happening. I mean, there's no good time to report a data breach such as this, but doing so just before the holiday shopping season is really the most unfortunate kind of timing that I can imagine. So depending on how bad the breach is, consumers could lose trust and confidence in the brand, and they could start to plan their holiday shopping at other retailers rather than risking their financial information with Forever 21. So not only is it going to be really tough to win back the customers that were affected, but also there just isn't an easy way to win back those lost sales either. And holiday shoppers are already wary of making purchases online due to cyber threats, and 66% of those shoppers wouldn't return to a store where their data was compromised. So it's really not looking too good. What can Forever 21 do at this point? Really, there's nothing that they could do but react to what has happened. So on that front, they're starting to engage with a leading security and forensics firm to assist with that investigation. And they're also providing additional details when it becomes more clear which specific stores and timeframes may have been involved. But for now, it appears there just isn't a lot of detail available. So overall, I kind of want to sum this up with saying that, you know, this incident is a reminder that retailers really need to remain constantly watchful and work closely with partners such as POS system vendors to assess ongoing threats, especially around times like the holidays.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It is a really unfortunate time for this to occur. I think it's almost more unfortunate considering the whole Riley Rose thing, and I think that there is their brand at the moment is it has to do everything right. When you're releasing a new product or you're releasing something such as a retail outlet, you need to make sure that your brand is completely on point. And something like this, negative PR is never a good thing. And you know, I completely make sense why they're the loser for this particular episode.
Yeah, like it could definitely impact the launch of Riley Rose, because sure, even though it's a subsidiary, you know, people could still be really wary that those types of data breaches can happen there as well.
Yeah, couldn't agree more.
So up next, we're going to jump into the retail roadmap. And this is an area where we focus on where retail is moving in the future. So today I want to talk about the holiday shopping season and speak about some trends that are happening around there. So typically, the holiday shopping season generates around 20% of the average retailer's annual revenue. And similar for brands as well, I think that number is even higher. Do you know, Chris?
I'm not too sure, to be brutally honest. I haven't read
it. So we can look that up. We can add that to our show notes. But generally, you know, that time really does add to a boost for both retailers and brands. Definitely. But 2017 is kind of proving to be difficult to forecast. Consumer confidence has increased, but the continued economic and political instability could potentially dampen shopper enthusiasm. So in spite of the potential instability, there are holiday shopping trends to expect as we move from Black Friday to the year end. So I'll go through a few trends, and all of these apply really to brands and to retailers at the same time. So the first one is omnichannel. You know, that's a word that we use a lot, but it's really not going anywhere, and we need to pay attention to it. So the trend really is that omnichannel retailers and brands who are creating an omnichannel experience are going to outperform online-only stores. So here's a stat that really stood out to me. 60% of customers expect to start and finish orders on separate platforms. 64% of shoppers want to execute online orders from inside stores. And 35% of in-store shoppers started their search on Amazon.com. So these stats show the fluidity of the customer journey from interest to purchase and the importance of being available to customers on all channels. So my point here is that an effective omnichannel strategy really requires having an integrated experience from the first touch to the final sale or even all the way through to an exchange or a return. And the one retailer that I wanted to point out that's doing really well with this is Nordstrom, and they're actually using Pinterest. I've never heard of a retailer actually using it like this. So they're using Pinterest to see what kind of brands and the and products people are pinning, and then they're putting those types of items front and center in its stores. So I found that to be really interesting. The next trend that I want to talk about is consumers choosing customer experience over savings. So the holiday season is synonymous with big discounts a lot of the time. But the strategy can only succeed if brands and retailers are making up for lost profits by increasing volumes. Shoppers, however, are really continuing to report on factors like product availability, quality, flexibility, transparency, convenience, and the service labels as more effective ways for brands and retailers to differentiate. So another really important trend to keep in mind. Another trend is the fact that millennials are driving experiential spending. So 75% of millennials say that they would rather spend money on travel and experiences rather than goods. And this preference made a significant impact on 2016 holiday spending. The average millennial budgeted almost $1,500 for holiday shopping, but they spent the greatest amount, almost 25%, on experiences. So what does this mean for retailers and brands, particularly those ones that don't necessarily sell something that could be categorized as an experience? So what savvy brands and retailers can do is really to tap into their millennial customers' needs for things like Snapchat and Instagram-worthy moments by creating better experiences in-store and better brand interactions in-store. So, for example, a number of brands have had really good success with using virtual reality, which we spoke about in a lot of our past episodes, in-store entertainment, and new technologies like humanoid robotics to enhance customer experience. So that was the last trend, but the bottom line here is that the 2017 holiday season is likely to bring us a lot of surprises, but retailers and brands that effectively blend the online and offline experience that make shopping fun and convenient and capture the imagination of shoppers are going to be the brands and the retailers that are going to win big during this time.
Yeah, no, I've done a little bit of reading myself on the whole holiday period because the shopping is probably not as intense in Australia as what it is over here in this particular time. And I've kind of noticed that over the last few years. But there's certain retailers that are kind of don't really want to take part in the holiday season and try and demote their brand in light of this season being there. One really good example I can think of is REI. So REI actually doesn't participate in Black Friday, I believe it is.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and they do it out of the fact that they believe in their brand, that it's strong enough. And I believe their whole marketing around it is everybody should go out and enjoy the great outdoors, I think it is, during that particular time as opposed to spending money. So I know Target's got some alternative strategies as well. What exactly they're doing, I don't want to say because I don't want to say something wrong, but I can remember, and I encourage everybody out in the audience to go and research it because Target's actually trying some alternative strategies. There's news during the week that Walmart is going to use different pricing strategies online and in-store, which I'm sure will fall into the holiday period as well. So there are a lot of brands trying a lot of new different things, and the trends that you've already touched on kind of go through those. But there's so much news to come out of this, and I'm sure this won't be the only episode that we talk about the holiday period and what brands are doing and what retailers are doing to really try and be successful over that time. Okay, so we've got through our winners and our losers and our retail roadmap for this particular episode. So what I want to talk about today, or what I'm going to go through today in our data dive section, is we'll be looking at measuring emotional responses emotional responses part of me through wearable technology and what the repercussions are for both brands and retailers moving forward. So a little bit of background on what wearable technology is. It's obviously anything like an Apple Watch, which has been around for quite some time now. And Fitbit is another really, really good example of wearable technology. But there's certain wearable technology that's coming out now that actually have sensors included on them that measure emotional responses to certain stimuli. So some brands that come to mind are Feel wristbands, Zenta wristbands. There's Muse headbands, which are kind of like meditational headbands, and Leaf smart jewelry as well. And what these wearable technologies do is they have sensors on them, as I mentioned, and they measure human reactions such as skin temperature, blood volume, pulse, and GSR, which is galvanic skin response. So it looks at sweat gland activity. These products that have been created have largely at the moment been used for health and wellness, and they're largely used to try and create a superhuman AI therapist, right? Now, you're probably wondering, how does this all relate to retail? What has this got to do with me? The reason I want to talk about it is the amount of data that comes out of this that could potentially be leveraged A, by retailers and B, by brands, but also what's being done in the retail and brand space. So there's an organization called Moxo. I believe they're out of Denver, Colorado, and they're a spin-off from an MIT project. And basically, it's the same idea. It's wearable technology. It's more sophisticated than your consumer technologies that you find. And what they do is they've actually been measuring certain emotional responses for retailers and brands to see how they react to certain consumers, react to certain products, and certain stimuli and certain layouts of retail stores, for example. So some of their findings include consumers love to engage through touch. So they tested consumers' emotional responses when they were actually playing with a product. And you can actually go to their website and see the graph. It's fascinating to see the kind of emotional response and the kind of arousal that a consumer will go through when they're actually physically playing with a product. They've also found that employee interactions can kill customer engagement. So they did this in the context of an electronic store, a consumer playing with a particular product, and a sales rep went up to that particular consumer to interact with them and found that their emotional response degraded really, really quickly, and they basically killed all interest that they have in a product, which seems counterintuitive, right? And it's counterintuitive to all the common knowledge that we know about sales. But something that's really insightful and really useful, and only something that's now available due to the technology and the data that we're able to accrue. They also found that opening a box to test a product stresses a consumer. Kind of goes back to the first finding that Moxo had found. And that goes into the whole thing about playing with a product. Consumers don't actually want to open the box, right? They want to have products there readily available to use and to play with. So what are the repercussions for brands? I guess it's now a race to see who's able to collect the most emotional data, right? So we've talked about RFID in the past. We've talked about measuring facial recognition. I think it was with the whole shelf talk, I think their name was, segment that we had in the data dive about how brands can respond. It's now looking at emotions and seeing how we can tie that into the data that we're able to use as brands and therefore tailor our products and tailor our offerings to consumers so it best suits their needs. As we move forward, and this is not something that's going to happen overnight, but as we discuss with something like Shelf Talk, brands are going to be able to respond a lot quicker to what's going on in the marketplace. There is a world that we could potentially live in where technologies such as Zenta and technologies such as Muse could be directly sold to retailers who can use it in real time to target their branding or to change their branding, pardon me, or to change their targeting to better be able to reach their consumers. So it's a really exciting time. I love talking about this kind of technology, and I have talked about it in the past because it is kind of that intersection between where technology is going, where retail is going, and where data is going, right? It just shows that all three of those things are integral in retail today for brands to be successful and for retailers to be successful as well.
That's very cool. And I think it kind of it goes back to that trend of athleisure making its way into and not just into activewear, but across categories like beauty and personal care. So yeah, really, really cool trend to highlight.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so we're at the conclusion of episode 10 of Retail Ramblings. Just really want to quickly touch over everything that we've gone through. So for our winners at this particular episode, we had Siwi Bath Company and the news that they're expanding to over 2,000 CVS stores, and also Mattel and the potential imminent merger with them and Hasbro. On our loser side, we had Whirlpool and Sears, and we kind of, determined that Sears was probably the bigger loser out of that one. And Forever 21 and a breach in some of their POS data, which is kind of a really scary thing. On the retail roadmap side of things, we spoke about trends in holiday season that is particularly in full swing in North America. And on the data dive, we had a look at wearable technology and its ability to measure emotional responses of consumers when presented with certain stimuli and the repercussions that we have for brands. So that brings us to the end of another episode. If you haven't done so already, please review us on iTunes. If you haven't subscribed, also subscribe, and we look forward to bringing you episode 11.